podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Ready to get your glitter on? Then head to Worlds of Fun Grand Carnival from July 23rd through August 7th for a larger-than-life shimmering celebration. Join the spectacle of color, a dazzling parade of floats, performers, music, and beads that sweeps across the park. And take your taste buds on a world tour while dancing to music after dark. Save over 45% with a Carnival bundle, which includes admission, parking, and 3 food tastings. Only at worldsoffun.com.
Hello, Toffees. Welcome back to Kickabout. It is, as usual, myself, Mark Mosey, joined as ever by Rob Vera. And Rob, we have a guest. Followers of your popular Twitter account will know who this person is already, but for listeners who have no idea who our third is, if our guest was to be arrested and you just found out seconds ago that he's been arrested, what would you assume that the charge was?
No, we're not going on this.
No, it's Matt Jones, Mark. I don't want to play this game because I think Matt's going to get really uncomfortable very quickly with even joking about police charges.
The reason I do this show is to get unwilling third members on and destroy their confidence.
Well, no, it's very rare when one of the Blue Room, like as I refer to them, one of the Blue Room tier one, the founders, if you will come down from their mountain to, hang out with the unwashed masses that are the Kickabout. But we do have Matt Jones, godfather of the Blue Room, the number 10 of the Blue Room, joining us today. Matt, unexpected day off and, weird scheduling week, and we get to have you on today. It's, do you go by Matt? Should I call you Matthew, Mr. Jones? What would you prefer?
Captain Blue Room.
This is definitely the weirdest intro we've ever been. Well, I'm sort of grumpy today, so I'm not really, sorry for not playing along.
You don't really get grumpy as well.
Today I have been, yeah.
The obvious reason today is that you had tickets to the now extinct test match at Old Trafford. As roller coasters of sport go, I'd say the last 24 hours of build up to this non-event has been right up there. But I don't know too much about kind of unfoldings about why this has eventually not happened. But what on earth is going on?
Well, all week, me and Paddy have been messaging because we were meant to be going together about the weather and worried about getting to Manchester and it pissing down all day, yeah, and therefore not seeing any cricket. And then sort of in the background, there's been this ongoing thing about one of India's physios has tested positive. But last night it was confirmed that the whole team had done PCR tests and they were all negative. So
yeah,
there's never really seems to be a threat of it getting cancelled. And then woke up this morning at about 8 o'clock after finishing work, about 2 a.m. this morning. A little bit tired, but ready to go. Just getting my stuff together, literally about to go out, and then Paddy texts me saying, have you seen the statement? It's off. So,
oh, God.
Shocker. Absolute shocker. So, in an alternative world, I should be nicely buried by now. I've just enjoyed a nice day at the cricket, making my way back into Manchester for a couple of hours around the Northern Quarter before getting the train back to Liverpool and, scrying a horrible takeaway on the way home. But instead, I've had a full day, and it's been pissing down here in Liverpool, and apparently it's been quite nice in Manchester. So,
Oh God, they're
so close. Manchester and Liverpool aren't that far from one another. It's odd that the weather is so different.
Yeah. Well, there is always that thing with the cricket, isn't it? That the weather will in some way scupper this. But was the most crushing image of your life when reporters at Old Trafford started posting pictures of a early afternoon sun breaking over the pitch?
Yeah, it was horrendous. It just got me really pissed off all day because I think the cricket's like one of those things you've got to book tickets for like well in advance as well. So like this has sort of been like in our calendar for about, well, probably over a year now.
I've
not been to a test match since 2016. And yeah, obviously the series has been great. It's been dead exciting. I know Rob's been keeping tabs on it throughout the summer.
Cricket ball normally lasts like 25 days in a row. So is it just today that's off, or do you get to go tomorrow?
The whole thing is off. Yeah, the whole thing is off.
Oh, you know? Man. Oh,
it's the last test of the series. India winning 2-1. But now there's loads of controversy over whether they forfeited or whether it's just going to... So it's going to be 2-2 or whether it's just going to be written off and be 2-1. But it's just a bit of a nightmare scenario for everyone. But, you know, I mean, for Aussie, obviously, it's not so bad from Manchester. But, you know, watching some of the coverage of it, people at the ground, like some people have come over from Ireland for the weekend for it and stuff like that. You know, people obviously come from all over the country. So just proper inconvenience, really. And, yeah, just what can you do? It's just an utterly shit situation.
Just deflating, isn't it, as you say? But
sorry to bring the mood of this podcast down.
Well, I'm not going to totally blow Rob's head off here by telling them that overcast conditions are actually quite desirable in cricket. But you know, this show will dive down that route every single week. More cricket terminology to follow next week. But in terms of the multi-sport start of the show, one person I did want to bring up, and Rob's already hating on which sport we've spoken about so far, but Emma Raducanu in the tennis is just unreal. Has anyone been following this girl's progress, not only generally, but through this particular tournament over in the US, Rob?
It was one of the handful of lead stories that I think I saw on ESPN this morning. I am not as good at following tennis and golf and, you know, the
cricket,
you know, the Dave Downey, Patty Boylan, Tory sports that you guys are. But I'm always interested, as most are, in a cool story. The fact that she's not just her age, but the fact that she was an unseeded player who had to go through the qualifying rounds to even get into the regular tournament, and now she's in the final is one of those incredible Cinderella stories. That's pretty cool. I think on the other side, it's probably just going to be Djokovic winning it again, which is sort of par for the course. But, you know, who knows? Either way, I think it's an incredible story. And it is nice to see it's two pretty young people in the final, it looks like, on the women's side. So it's nice to, you know, it's always nice to see see kind of a new generation breaking through in a sport that at times can be dominated by just a small handful of the elite of the elite. So, yeah, no, very, very cool story. Is she playing? Who is she playing in the final?
Layla Fernandez, her name is.
Yeah. So as you say,
where is she from?
Canada.
Oh, there you go.
Canada or the UK? I don't know who I root for in that case. It's kind of a weird one, you know. Yeah.
The 7th or 8th time that both competitors in a Grand Slam final have been teenagers. Yeah, I think Emma is the first qualifier, as you mentioned then, Rob, to ever play in a Grand Slam final, which is just absolutely insane. Oh, wow. I think the massive escalation could probably be summarized by the fact that she had flights home booked from America after her qualifying games. And she
didn't even believe she would get that far. So
it was obviously a massive shock at Wimbledon when she did all right. But I think you kind of... portion a little bit of that to just home crowd and the comforts of being in your own country for such a big tournament. But Matt, I think to go over to America, as Rob said, there's no real clear elite in the WTA as there is in the kind of Djokovic, Federer, Nadal, and to a lesser extent, unfortunately, these days, Andy Murray have kind of dominated the entire sport over here. But absolute massive shock to see her perform so well, even the, you know, quarterfinal in the week, we were kind of that was unbelievable territory. But this is just another universe for her.
Yeah, I feel like over here the coverage is on Amazon Prime, isn't it? So I think you know, typically in the US Open's been on, I think it's been on BBC, Eurosport, Sky at times, and people have been a bit more aware of it. But it felt like people didn't really pick up on the fact that how well she was doing until probably, like you said, so she got to the quarterfinals, was it? So I think people have been staying up and watching. I think that the final is about 9 p.m. British time, isn't it, on Saturday? So people will be able to watch it, which is which is decent. But yeah, there were signs in the summer, weren't there, ever being just like ridiculously good? And
yeah,
I think she got a lot of flack from your typical, you know, right wing heads after she pulled out of that match with, you know, I think she afterwards she said, you know, she had a bit of a panic attack on court and stuff like that. And people gave her a bit of grief for it, sort of said maybe this is going to hold her back. And, you know, very next Grand Slam tournament, she's come three rounds better and, yeah, and into the final. But I've not seen much of this tournament, to be honest, but obviously it's an unbelievable achievement. Mm. My main piece of analysis on Raducanu is that every time I see her, she just looks exactly the same as James Rodriguez. She's just got his face.
Oh man! Well, I was just going to say that the book is the book, and the Netflix deal is just kind of creating itself out. You know, with this story, it's incredible. But if she looks like James Rodriguez, then
but if people listen to this now, honestly, I'm not seeing a picture of her. Just pause. Find a picture of her, find a picture of James, and put them together. And they are doppelgangers. They look so similar.
I gotta get a look at this James looking fox that you're describing here.
But like during the summer, I remember watching my first match, and I was just sat there for ages thinking, she just looks like somebody, and I can't think who it is.
I do get it, I must admit.
So that's my main analysis on her.
I'm lost in that now. Rob, you mentioned about ESPN.
Sorry, I'm just imagining her saying "up the toffees," you know, to the camera.
I think she's really a red, isn't she?
Oh God, is she?
Fucking course she is. You know, because that's just how it always is. Yeah. Since she's from Liverpool, then.
No.
Oh, she's not. Well, that's a shock. Okay. Well, that's a curveball I wasn't expecting. She's a bandwagoner. Got it.
But I think one of the great things about this story is that people have latched onto is the, you know, I think one of the juxtapositions of the week in terms of the British press was, I think, it was on the front of the Daily Express, where there was a headline saying "send them back" in regards to people trying to get across the channel, immigrants. Yeah. And then on the next panel next to that, it was something about RM are doing really well, and Raducanu is actually the dad is from Bucharest in Romania, and her mum is from Shenyang in China, and she herself was born in Canada and moved to England at a young age. So, you know, it's a great story from her point of view, and a sort of a great example of what someone from a modern England can do and go on to accomplish. But, you know, like I said, there's that ridiculous sort of contrast on the front of the Express this week. We just thought, you know, someone needs to give their head a bit of a wobble there.
Well, I felt like for someone who put that story together, what you've said is absolutely true. I assume some top-level editor has checked that front page at the point where it was handed to him pre-print and said, yeah, let's crack on with that. There are two stories, but yeah, as you say, just absolute bonkers. Rob, I wasn't going to mention this, but you mentioned sport and highlights on ESPN, and it instinctively took me back to this morning in bed, waking up to watch very early stages of the new NFL season. Didn't want to do this, man, but
it's fun.
Dallas Cowboys, discuss.
Oh, you have to understand that the Cowboys had broken me by the time I even started following Everton. So they really can't hurt me at all. But it was just speaking as a pure football fan, an American football fan, I guess, if I need to clarify for the majority of our audience. You couldn't have asked for a better opening game. It was incredible. The Cowboys and the Bucks both, you know, they played well. There were turnovers, there were mistakes, there were events in the game, there was drama at the end, big kicks missed and made, and you know, all kind of the normal stuff. It was, you know, the Bucks are the defending, they're the title holders, the defending champs, so they were heavily favored in this game. One of the larger spreads, I think it was like 8.5, 9 points, something like that, favorites, which is a pretty big, pretty substantial line between, you know, two pretty decent teams. But I think the Cowboys acquitted themselves well. It just came up short. But more than anything, I'm just happy for the NFL to be back. It's always interesting because there's such a, I don't know if it's sort of like, just having having a drink of something and then drinking something totally different. It's like having a drink that's always going to be the same, and then suddenly having a drink where the same four drinks don't win the title every single year. It's hard to kind of quantify what the NFL means to me in that regard. But I have no idea what's going to happen in the NFL this season, and I look forward to every minute that I can get of it. And we've got Red Zone coming back this Sunday, which has become increasingly a big tradition amongst several of our Blue Room brethren who watch the back and forth of all the games every week. So and we've got a fantasy league going. Matt has joined our fantasy football league this season, and I'm looking forward to having a minute. But yeah, glad it's back.
How'd you start fantasy football week one, Matt?
Shite. So I'm in two leagues this year, and Godwin, who scored a touchdown last night and had a pretty good game for the Bucks, was on my bench in the team I've got in Rob's league, but I started him in the other league I'm in. So a bit of a mixed bag, really. So happy in one sense that he got points in one league, but unhappy in the other. I also had Ezekiel Elliott, who I think was my fourth pick overall. First round pick, fourth pick overall, a sort of like go-to stud player, and he was badly shite, so it doesn't really bode well for the rest of the season. But
that was a bad matchup last night, and they were never going to, even if they tried to run against Tampa Bay, that wasn't really the best plan. So
it sort of felt like with the Cowboys last night, it would be like the equivalent of Everton starting the season with like a 3-2 loss against Man City, but playing really well.
It felt
like there's sort of like quite a lot for them to take forward from it. Tough first game, obviously, against the Super Bowl champions, and great player in Brady. Looked really good again, didn't he? But I'm sure it'll be fine. Can't wait for Sunday. Really excited for Red Zone.
When will Brady stop being this Tom Brady? You guys
will know Mark
better than me, but in terms of age,
it's like asking you're basically asking the question. When someone signs a deal with Satan, when does the upside of the deal run out? I mean, I don't know. Assuming he'd have to die at this point. look, Tom Brady is the greatest player in the history of this sport. I don't really even think it's that close at this point. He's the best. He's the greatest player at the most important position in the sport, and no one can really deny that. He has extended his career from a health perspective by a combination of his choices, his infamous diet that includes apparently no carbs, no sugar, no alcohol. I guess he just is able to get his satisfaction in life from, all the winning and being married to the most famous supermodel in the world. I mean, if that's what you're going for, I guess he's accomplished something, in that regard. But he's also been very fortunate, frankly, in ways that many of his peers over the years have not been in terms of injuries. He's never had the type of major injury that derails a career, or, in the case of like Peyton Manning, for instance, starting to have spinal fusion surgery and things like that. I mean, there's just, it is a combination of just intense preparation every season, combined with self-discipline and sprinkled in with a little bit of luck, but he's incredible. It just doesn't surprise anymore, and he will play as long as he wants to. The notion in sport of the clock running out on everyone is true, but he has found a way to extend that clock longer than we've ever seen before. So I don't really know what the answer is. He says he's playing still because he just likes to play, and he's still really good at it. And so therefore he will just, when he stops playing, I think will be whenever he feels like it. But I feel like for the last half decade plus, there's been a question of, is this the year he's going to maybe say he doesn't want to do it anymore? But then he just keeps going out and winning. And so he doesn't seem to feel the need to quit. He said, he told Tampa when he signed there last season that he'd be there at least 2 years. But by all indications, this will not be his final year. I would not be shocked if he was starting an NFL game at the age of 48 or something like that. Why be shocked at this point? If he's doing this at the age of 44 in the most physical, you know, and arguably the most physical, physically punishing sport on earth, I don't really know what else to say about him. He's transcendent.
I think as well, Robbie, maybe not so much in his early days in New England, but certainly once he was sort of the bedrock of the team and they could build around him, all the pieces were there to sort of help him, weren't they? You know, he had a great line in front of him that protected him pretty well for the majority of those seasons. And that's probably why he's been able to sort of avoid injuries and stuff like that. And now he's gone to another team in Tampa who are sort of maybe not quite at that level. But again, he's pretty well protected. He doesn't have to go like legging out of the pocket all the time and take loads of open field tackles and stuff like that. He's adapted his game in that sense. So I think that's, you know, sort of to bring this back to cricket, you know, hey, come on, we've crossed into yours. But someone like James Anderson, who's 39, and he's still playing cricket at a ridiculously high level. And you think of someone like him, and it's only really in the last couple of test matches towards the end where England have got a lot of like bowlers out injured at the moment, and like an extra burden has been put on him physically against a really good team. And you know, it's only now where you look at him and think, he's getting a bit tired now. Whereas if you go back down the years when he's had some...
Is that like, James
Anderson? Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I remember hearing about him, yeah.
So you sort of go back down the years and he's had someone like Stuart Broad there who's been like his opening bowling partner for 15 years to rely upon, and they've shared the load together throughout their entire career, and it's only now with that split up that they've had to take on more of the load. So I think as much as these people are ridiculously talented... maybe a bit of a nod to the teammates as well for helping them and protecting them and getting them to that level, because, you know, talent alone and luck alone, I don't think get you playing elite level sport. You know, in the case of Anderson, in the case of Brady, so, you know, Brady, the greatest of all time in American football, Anderson, the leading wicket taker all time in Test cricket. You know, I think it's, you need a bit more than talent, you need a bit more than luck, you need a bit more than, you know, consistency. I think it's, especially in team sport, it's about the lads and the girls who are around you as well.
As we head into a weekend where Cristiano Ronaldo makes his second debut for Man United, is it fair to bring him into that echelon as well, in terms of people who just absolutely defy the narrative of weakening performance with age? I mean, I've seen a few people kind of speculating ahead of this season about how much he is actually able to deliver now. I don't see that guy falling off at any moment. I mean, there's absolutely no way that fella plays football against some of the teams that we've watched over the last 4 or 5 years in this league and doesn't score 20-odd goals. So I think that'll be an interesting one. It's been interesting, actually, to read some of the numbers behind that transfer. And, you know, depending on what blag Twitter account you want to believe is where you go in terms of what is accurate. But some of the reports that Man United have made sort of £160, £170 million already on shirt sales and advertising and whatever else you can pin on that guy, because he's such a global focal point, obviously. But I think there's been, not uproar, but semi-discontent over here, Matt, about not actually being able to see Ronaldo's first game back. On the back of a season where we were absolutely spoiled for televised football, is that something that's going to start irking you again this year, or are you happy to sacrifice that?
Let's talk about blackout rules, please. I can't wait to talk about this. Go ahead.
No, absolutely not. I think it's something that needs to be protected completely for me. And you know, where it would direct people is people. I'm sure everyone follows Dale Johnson from ESPN on Twitter, and he put a really great thread up about this the other day. About it's not necessarily say at the weekend, if you know there's a team like Oldham playing near United, this isn't a case of an Oldham season ticket holder saying Ronaldo's playing at Old Trafford in his return on Saturday, I'm not going to go to my Oldham game where I've got a season ticket because I'm going to stay at home and watch that on the television. Mm-hmm. It's for people who are casuals and walk-ups and potential opportunities for those clubs to get people hooked in. You know, season tickets holders at clubs anywhere in the country aren't going to abandon their team to watch a fella play against Newcastle United. But it's not really something that bothers me, to be honest. And I think you're probably right. Over the course of the pandemic, we all sort of got used to being drip-fed football. It was all right without ever being great because no fans were in there. I did quite enjoy the staggered kickoff times as well. I mean, you could sort of watch a game at any point really over the weekend. But I totally get why the blackout rule is in place. And, you know, I imagine for someone like Robert and anybody else in the world, you know, that they can sort of watch this game sort of without any sort of inhibitions, any sort of restrictions. But, you know, anyone who wants to legally watch Cristiano Ronaldo play for Manchester United on a second debut in England or Scotland has got to be in the stadium. And that in itself is a little bit strange, but I totally get why these blackout rules are in place. I'm sure in the future there'll be more negotiations about it, and I'm sure the pandemic and this Ronaldo, you know, debacle will drag it under if more scrutiny again, and there'll be more chat about it going forward. But I don't mind it. I think it's just one of those things that people will get used to again after we get back into the swing of the schedule coming back and fans being back in grounds.
I mean, I definitely indulged on football televised during the pandemic to a point where it was just not fun anymore. I don't reckon you'd ever get to this stage because you love this game far more than I do, and I am fine to admit that. But it felt like it was just way too much in the absence of all other hobbies and interests. Rob, what we've said there about English football and the availability that the US has to it, does it ever get to that overindulgence point for you?
Well, I acknowledge, I think what Matt says is really steeped in a very specific sort of cultural tradition there of basically there being protectionism and saying that people don't need to have choices, that choices need to be made for them in regards to what they can or can't view. And that's just, it's just a completely different mindset here.
But it's not just that, Rob. It's protecting. There's no football league system on the planet that is deep and as, you know, as widely attended as there is in England. And I think it's something that the Football League are obviously very proud of. And with that in mind, this is why this is sacrosanct. Because if you start letting people, you know, if you start putting broadcast of, you know, the biggest teams on the television all the time, then all of a sudden that's going to gradually erode away.
You mean the biggest teams in England aren't on the TV all the time?
Well, they're not on all the time, are they? United aren't on Saturday at 3 o'clock. You know, Manchester City weren't on when they played Norwich the other week at 3 o'clock in that 5-0 game. There is still sort of a, and I know what you're saying. Probably 2/3 of the time they are on the television.
Yeah, here's my perspective. I find the notion that this tradition persists out of some respect for the sacred nature of the footballing pyramid to be kind of precious when that same footballing pyramid system continues to perpetuate massive, widespread systemic inequality between these clubs and has a completely broken financial system and does nothing to protect many of these clubs who suffered greatly during COVID. But, you know, I guess this is the one way that they get protected somehow. I mean, I think it's fine. It's all well and good. I mean, I think it's just, you could just say to me, hey, this is the way it's always been, so that's how it's going to be. And that, let that be your argument. I also understand, like I said, that this is a very specific cultural tradition, over there. I kind of feel like, I feel like if you continue, I think you can take choice away from people to a degree as much as you want to try. But I do sort of think that flies in the face of the current trajectory of the world in regards to, you know, you can say illegal streams, you can say, you know, a culture of people of this generation who are growing up in a totally on-demand culture where they can watch anything they want to pretty much at any time, except for this. And this is the one thing where, nope, sorry, we're gonna tell you that this is the this is the line we're gonna draw. We're not going to punish the richest clubs in the world for completely, you know, sucking the blood out of the entire footballing pyramid. We are not going to punish them for dalliances with the Super League. We are not going to enforce any sort of even notion of an even or fair playing ground, but we are going to draw the line at this. So I think part of me finds that to be wildly inconsistent. I think it's cute. I think it's a nice little tradition that you guys seem to be fine with. So if you guys are cool with not having the option to watch games that you would rather watch, that's certainly fine. I can't even relate to that here. I mean, I think the closest thing over here in America when I was growing up, and I think it's mostly gone now, but the NFL used to have a blackout rule that said if the game was not sold out in the stadium, in the local market, they would black out the game. So what that meant was, back when the Cowboys were terrible, like really terrible, not just the sort of basic garden variety abject failure that they are these days, but I mean like when they were 3-13 and 1-15 and only 2/3 of the tickets were sold to a game, they would black out the game in the entire Dallas-Fort Worth area market, right? So people couldn't watch it. And those were sort of the rules back then. But we're so far down the rabbit hole here of being able to purchase packages that enable us to watch Red Zone is a great example of that. Like the reason people love Red Zone so much is that they have the ability to kind of watch every game going on, hopping and skipping around, but they also can buy NFL Sunday Ticket and literally just be able to press a button and watch any game going on concurrently when they want to. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, it's not a perfect apples and oranges comparison. These are different countries of different sizes, different cultural traditions, different sports. I acknowledge all of that. I read that thread that Matt is referring to. He makes a lot of really nice points and sound points about why, and you know, how this is about protecting the casual, you know, the clubs in terms of that revenue that they get from the quote casual walk-up fan who, since they can't watch Ronaldo, are going to decide, well, I'm not going to, you know, I think it's a bit head in the sand, because I tend to think that if a casual fan of a sport or whatever, if he can't watch Ronaldo that day, he's probably just going to turn on Netflix and watch a movie or something like that, or a TV show, as opposed to going out to a footballing ground. I don't know what the actual economic impact is of the quote walk-up fans, because as Matt said, this isn't about season ticket holders who are going to go no matter what. It's mm-hmm. about these casual walk-up fans.
Yeah.
It must be a considerable amount of money that I don't fully have my arms wrapped around. But again, I find the notion that the footballing pyramid cares so much about this when they don't seem to care about fairness in any other regard to be wildly inconsistent, but that's just my perspective.
I don't necessarily think it's their decision, is it? It's not the footballing pyramid saying where, you know, we want to do this. It's sort of like a plethora of different things. It's the broadcast companies as well. It's the FA and the Football League and the Premier League are probably all after adhere to this. And I think I know what you're saying about, you know, the people at the top of this footballing pyramid have obviously showed in recently that they've got no real regard for equality across the game, really, and were willing to sort of pull the drawbridge up at a moment's notice. But just because that was wrong doesn't mean that you should lift something in the blackout which helps preserve some kind of, you know, it's not equality, but it's stopping it from becoming even less lopsided towards them, if that makes sense. You know, just because it's shit already doesn't mean that you should do something that's going to make it even shitter.
Two wrongs don't make a right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but it's, you know, it just
10 wrongs don't make a right or whatever. Yeah, 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 I get it. No, and by the way, Matt, I think Matt makes a really articulate argument on this, and I don't. I get Matt where you're coming from on it. I fully acknowledge that my perspective is completely skewed by growing up here and being from here and being a, you know, despite having followed the Premier League for 17 years or whatever, I know that I am still kind of I've still come to this game and this sport and this tradition relatively late on compared to those who've grown up with it. So I acknowledge all of that. I'm just letting you know from my perspective, I find the whole thing a little odd, but mm-hmm. I also think that it is sort of just the way it is. What I do wonder, and I'm curious what you guys think about this, is that how long can this tradition sort of hold up against the winds of change in regards to just the increasing access to, I don't know, everything that we all seemingly have more and more in terms of our viewing options and so on. And what does that portend, I guess, for these clubs who are currently, you know, protected to a degree by these blackout rules?
I think there's an element of, if it's not changed at this point, I can't really foresee anything that would tip that towards a massive change of the rules. I mean, for all of the money that is in the game and all of the things that you've mentioned about, you know, protecting the integrity of the pyramid and the walk-up fans, etc., I feel like this game is at its most powerful stage probably ever. You look at it now as a product, and in particular in this country, as being one that is so governed by finance that you kind of look at that now, and for all the reasons that you mentioned about kind of like the broadcasters and the FA, if they've not managed to get their hands on this element of the game and change it for that kind of Americanized model that you've mentioned, Rob, you know, this kind of, we've seen it a little bit over here with the BT Gold show during the Champions League and that kind mm-hmm. of setup that you mentioned about, you know, red zone, but you can kind of switch and head over to any particular match that you like. It almost didn't, when I was watching that goal show, I don't know really how I felt about this. And Matt, you probably watch a lot of Champions League football during this format as well, but it felt a bit weird having that much access to it. And I think that's just the traditionalism of the game in the country being drilled into you. But it did feel a bit odd to have that much access. And I mean, you know, romantic football fans will kind of appreciate the tradition of not being able to necessarily see absolutely every moment of action until match of the day, or if you're an Everton fan and you avoid
match of the day
every single weekend, then you might see it on a highlight reel later on in the season. But yeah, it's definitely something that is going to be a very difficult thing to change over here, purely probably based on tradition.
It doesn't sound like there's a big push to change it either. Am I right? Like, I think that's the thing, is that
even from the consumer,
I am in the distinct minority. Apparently most people there are cool with all this. And so, and the other thing too, to remember, guys, and this is where I don't want to say something that comes off as offensive in terms of acknowledging the realities of the situation, but to the point we've been talking about, the model, if you will, of allowing anyone to watch any of the games going on at any time, is the model everywhere else but the UK.
Yeah.
And at least in terms of this. And so the reason I bring that up is because, You said before, like, why haven't the broadcasters seem to be okay with this and blah, blah, blah. Well, I think it's because the broadcasters are getting their money from America and from Europe and from Asia and all, you know, in China and all these other places where the on-demand to watch any game you want at any time option is there. The UK makes up such a small percentage now, relatively, because we talk about this sport and the league now, especially the Premier League, being this sort of global brand in this global league. UK fans, as a total number or a total share of that, are now a relatively small percentage of that overall. And therefore, you can make this exception in the UK for tradition or whatever, you know, people argue or what the demand really is, because everyone else in every other country is getting it, getting to watch it in whatever way that they want to. And so that's not a slight on anyone. I think that's just acknowledgement of the math here. And I think that that's probably why this has not become a huge issue outside of the occasional, I wish we could watch Ronaldo's debut. Every other important match that they're ever going to want to watch is, you know, especially as it comes to European football and Champions League, they're going to see. So I guess it's probably not as big an issue as I would maybe imagine that it would have been.
I wouldn't even be watching it anyway. It'd be an absolute circus, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I mean,
that you had to watch Newcastle.
What do you guys think of?
But this has been in place since the 1960s, hasn't it, as well?
Yeah.
So it's all as like a concept, it's almost like grown roots in English football. And it's just, you know, when someone's been around for that long, it's been, and you know, and it's been just part of the game. And like Rob said, without any real sort of opposition or scrutiny, then it's going to take something seismic for it to shift and change. And arguably, you could say over the past 18 months, we've had that seismic thing, which has changed it. Things did change.
Yeah.
All matches were on. The kickoff times were staggered. And some people liked it, some people didn't. But you sort of get the impression that if there was real appetite for this from the clubs, from the Premier League, from the FA, that sort of drip feeding it to us all during the pandemic, and then on the other side of the pandemic when fans are allowed back in the stadium, it would have been like the, a nice go-between for them to implement this on a full-time basis. You know, we've been doing this for a while. It's worked a little bit. Let's see what it's like this season at least. And then, you know, we might readdress it. But they haven't. They've gone straight back to the old model. So I think with that in mind, while there's been quite a bit of discussion about it this week, and you know, there's a lot of United fans who are getting pissy about not being able to see Ronaldo on Saturday until match of the day. Well, Sky have seen a show in the highlights at 5:15, aren't they, as soon as the blackout ends. But so while there's all that going on, generally, aside from this week, probably from 1960 when this rule was introduced up until this week, there's not really been that much opposition to it, and there doesn't really seem like a major appetite from the governing bodies to change it.
Well, and for those of you who, you know, for those in America or really in other places, but in America especially, listening to this, like, you know, when I growing up in the 80s, you would have, before all of these options, you would have for like the NFL, for instance, or even baseball, before baseball was on every single day on every channel, you know, you would have like the game of the week, or in the case of the NFL, you would have the you know, I'm talking in central time terms, but the noon kickoff, the 3 p.m. kickoff on two different channels. And you would have maybe a total of three games that you got to watch that day. And so at night, when ESPN or NBC or whomever did, or CBS did the big wrap-up show with all the highlights, it was must-watch because that might be the only time you got to ever see any of these other teams, especially if you were in a, quote, market where you were going to see the Cowboys every week but wouldn't see, like, my dad growing up, you know, like, he's a Jets fan, but he lived in Texas. Like, he grew up in New York but lived in Texas, never got to see them much. So I can't stress enough, and this has just been based on my time spent in the UK with these guys, but I don't think many Americans who listen to this can fully appreciate how big a deal match of the day is over there. It is this cultural institution of, you know, like, it has all of this huge cachet and is a must watch because it is the only time a lot of fans get to, you know, that those are the first time they're going to get to see highlights from those games in that particular day. And therefore, because of that exclusivity, it heightens the discussion to being, quote, more important. Whereas if everyone saw every game and there were comment, you know, and there was analysis and instant feedback of, you know, around those games, maybe that's what we get out of Twitter, obviously, then match of the day would just be another kind of run of the mill highlight show. The match of the day is this huge thing there, in a way that is hard to understand, For an American audience, for instance, who is just used to having everything available and able to see the highlights, you know, instantaneously. So that's, I think that that's one of the differences that you have to sort of appreciate when you visit there, in terms of like knowing that you're going to only maybe be able to watch a few games on TV, but that everyone at the end of the day who's into football is going to be watching Match of the Day on Saturday night or on Match of the Day 2 on Sunday.
I reckon it's been years since I watched Match of the Day, you know. Just
really?
Not
because the way everyone talks about it, like it's just this must watch. And Matt watches it every week. I know you do, Matt.
It definitely is. I mean, you know, there's Everton result connotations here about how clean you are for 20 past 10 on a Saturday night to roll around. But I don't know. I think once you've become so accustomed to, I don't know, the purity, is that the right word, of being in the ground? And obviously we've been able to rekindle that in the last few weeks. It all feels a little bit diluted when you're watching it on highlights. And in particular for Everton, I'm probably not someone who goes back and watches Everton games or Everton highlights. And I know this is probably the first season where I'm told via the Everton website you can do that for full 90 minutes. But I kind of like to live it in that moment. And usually most of the time, absolutely, totally forget what I've seen. But it even in the nice moments and the occasional last minute wins and things, that, do you know what, the one moment that I've probably watched consistently over and over again to a bizarre point that I would never normally do is Decore's goal against Southampton. It just felt like one of those goals that absolutely demanded to be watched. But
not the Richarlison goal against Liverpool you know, last season. I feel like I watched that 100 times at least.
Probably not as much. And do you know what? In years to come, when it's been 30 years since our last derby win, when Richarlison and Gylfi Sigurdsson scored, I'll probably watch it a hell of a lot more at that point. But no, on the subject,
I still watch that James McFadden goal against Charlton probably once a month.
Yeah, I'll give you that one.
For me, it's the ones with fans behind the goal, the backdrop, whether it's away or at the Gladys Street end, Just the sort of like the canvas that's painted by just, you know, bodies flying everywhere, and you know, in the stand behind the goal is always fantastic. I think they're the ones for me that, regardless of the goal and how it's scored and how it goes in, you just, you know, I think the goals that I really love watching back. So think of Theo Walcott against Watford in front of that away end, everyone sort of knows he's going to score a couple of seconds before he actually scores. So you can just see the away end. There's people like hands on the heads. There's some people like the hands up in the air. There's like some people like bouncing up and down, like in anticipation. There's some who are like crouched down, ready to just go.
Like, you had that confidence that Walcott would score? I didn't.
When you're in the ground, I imagine you're that close to it, and you see there's an open goal effectively for him to slot it in. You have that little second of it's gonna go off now. And I think when you sort of can see all of that, when you watch it on the television, it is boss.
The two
that Matt. Oh, I'm sorry, Mark. I was just going to say, my wife was super annoyed with me because I kept the DVR recording of the Palace match at home that I went to with Matt, where I sat in the Gladys Street and I cried like a baby when we scored and we won the game. Like, because I ended up going back, and I would just, you know, for a few months, every few days, I'd just go to the DVR and I'd watch that last sequence where Calvert-Lewin scored and then Cenk Tosun scored. I think it's probably more particular types of memories for me. But you're right. Like, I don't want to watch highlights constantly, and certainly Everton don't give me just the desire to watch them, you know, over and over again. But I think it probably all depends on the moment more than anything else.
Well, speaking of staggered kickoff times, Telfair's games, and being a disgrace to the footballing pyramid, Everton are back on Monday at 8 o'clock on Sky Sports. A couple of players that I want to talk about heading into this game. I mean, someone who we've spoken about consistently over the summer for what feels like a million different reasons is James Rodriguez. And I feel like personally, my attitude towards him and what I want from him and the whole relationship between him and Rafael Benitez and him and Everton changes on a near weekly basis at the moment. I'm blinded at the moment by the fact that I've just realized that he's got a face like a teenage tennis player. But in the last couple of days, I've felt myself, Rob, leaning more towards the fact that it's absolutely essential that we actually obtain a footballer out of this lad now, as opposed to some form of financial package which benefits us in the future. Clearly, with every passing European and world transfer deadline, it seems more apparent that he is going to have to, in some way, become part of this squad. Rafael Benitez has said as much today in terms of being very honest in terms of the fact that there was interest in him. He kind of nodded towards the fact that there was a will for the club to try and make a deal with any other available club. I mean, we were going right down to the bottom of the Turkish Super League at one point just to try and get this lad out the door. And as much as there were financial benefits and possibly relationship benefits to doing that, are you now in the mindset whereby you're excited again to see this lad being reintegrated into the team?
I don't know excited is the word, but as we discussed at length last week, it's just as a matter of practicality, he's got to be. You can't look, there are multiple parallel truths here. And Matt, I heard you guys discussing this on the weekly to a degree. I mean, the bottom line is that you're, regardless of the fact that he is not a fit, and the reason he's not a fit is not just Rafa Benitez. It's frankly, he's not a fit just because of where we are as a club. He is a luxury player that you want to have in a really talented Champions League squad. We're just not that side. I mean, we had all the good intentions, but you know, things changed. But having said that, once the window shuts, the reality is that, and when these other windows shut, and I don't really think he was ever going to Portugal or Turkey or whatever, even though I hoped he would go to Portugal to make the Luis Diaz thing happen. But I mean, the reality of the situation is that you are, you being Everton and James Rodriguez, they are stuck. They are joined at the hip now, at least until January. You are paying him, apparently, I didn't realize until more of this seemed to come out more recently. I think it's $200,000 a week. For some reason, I thought it was less than that before, but yeah. $200,000 a week is so much money. Everton can't afford, and use that word afford on any level you choose to, they cannot afford to have a $200,000, cinder block just sitting there. I mean, they've got to find some use out of it, out of him. He needs Everton and he needs to play football because he wants to play for Colombia in the upcoming World Cup. So regardless of the mutual feelings of, you know, admiration or lack thereof, their interests are aligned for whatever reasons, and they therefore need to make some kind of meaningful contribution happen. Not least of which, you know, of the reasons are involve, frankly, the fact that I think that for pure fan service, you need to play this guy. I think all of the gallows humor about how we, you know, the irony of him playing at Everton during a COVID season and no one was ever going to see him play and blah, blah, blah. Well, now we've moved past the window. So to me, I feel like Everton owe it to their fans to use this guy and allow him to have some special moments so that, you know, 5-10 years from now, we can see a cute little highlight on an anniversary of a goal that the Twitter account puts out or whatever. But frankly, and I say this selfishly, I'm coming to Goodison for the final home game before the January window opens. It could be as fair. Like, I selfishly want to see James Rodriguez play. I'm just someone from out of town coming in to visit. You know, season ticket holders, I imagine, even if you're annoyed by all the bits on Twitch and whatever, and you just don't like the modern footballer, I guess maybe I'm talking about park enders, I don't know. But I think that ultimately, this guy is a talent. He is a special talent. And you, the whole reason we watch this sport, other than, you know, hoping they win something at some point, is also to see these kind of special moments, because that's frankly where we are as a club. We are here to enjoy our moments when we get them. And he is a moment maker. I want to see him play, and I know I'm not alone in that. And I feel like if you're going to be paying him 200 grand anyway, you might as well get what you can get out of him, help move things forward a little bit. And if you can find a good deal for him in January or next summer, then fine, do that. But there's no point not to have him play. Now, I will say from the press conference this morning, it sounds like Rafa Benitez is not some kind of hardliner about this. I think he was very practical and pragmatic about it. And now he's kind of acknowledged that, well, he's going to be here. So yeah, he's going to need to get his fitness back up and he's going to play, but he's got to play. He's just got to play. I don't see any other argument that makes sense.
The one line I did like from the press conference, which Benitez added, was, "It was not easy because he was available in the transfer window. Now that we have just the Middle East window, it is not easy." Is that his final just temptation out into the global market of he's still everyone?
Bernard went there, didn't he? Maybe he put a word in.
Join his life. Yeah, he could go and join in.
I mean, it's obvious that they want to shift him, isn't it? You know, it's just you know, the manager's basically come out and said as much there, but... I don't know, maybe we're just overanalyzing this all a bit because of who it is. And because there is this sort of mystique around him that sort of intensified at the start of his first season and then sort of filtered away. And now he's intensified again because he's here and because of who he is and because of the manager and the previous relationship. And maybe it's just going to simply be a case of player came to a football club because of a manager. Manager leaves, player's just got to get on with it.
Yeah,
you know, that's just how it is. Obviously, this is not quite the same situation, but I remember when Maurizio Sarri left Chelsea, and upon him leaving after, I think, he was only there for one season, wasn't he, in the end? And everyone was sort of saying, what about Jorginho? You know,
yeah.
He only came to Chelsea because of Jorginho. He only came to Chelsea because, you know, of the system that Sarri plays. How is he going to cope without Maurizio Sarri knocking around? And, you know, what did he win, European Player of the Year this season? You know, starred in the Champions League for Chelsea when they won it, starred in the Euros for Italy. He's obviously had a good time of things. And, you know, obviously the club want to get rid of him, but I think if he's here, hopefully it's just a case of Everton realise they've got a good player on the hands. The manager realises that he's got a good player on his hands. Just get your head down. Both of you get your head down and just act like grown-ups for 6 months or whatever it is, or 9 months until the end of the season when you can go your separate ways. Obviously, it's not a situation I think either of them would want to be in. But at the end of the day, Rodriguez is an experienced player who was coming towards the end of his career. You know, let's not forget, last summer, I think he said he was thinking about maybe retiring after the World Cup in 2022.
Yeah.
So he's coming to based on his own timeline, which he said himself, he is getting close to the end of his playing days. Benitez has been around the block a lot. He knows that despite a good start at Everton, he's going to need to earn favour and he's going to have to be canny in the way in which he does it and in his Everton career. And getting this lad in the team at times and getting him playing in front of a packed Goodison Park is one way of doing that, because we are fickle as fans and there is a mystique around this lad, whether he's worth it or not at this point. So I just sort of hope that maybe we've all looked into this a bit too much. I think it was interesting to listen to Alan speak on the weekly about their relationship at Madrid and how maybe we've sort of overblown the fact that they may not like each other. I think it's probably more of a system and a style thing rather than a personality thing based on what he was saying. But ultimately, you look at both of them and you'd say that the clock is sort of, well, they're both sort of in the twilight of the careers. Mm. In fact, they're both probably in a very similar position, aren't they, in the careers at this point? You know, they are on the other side of the peak as a player and a manager, and I think they both just ultimately got to get their head down and work at it and try and find a way. Hopefully that's it. Hopefully it's just as straightforward as that. It probably isn't. You'll probably go on Twitch tonight and say something mad, and you know, we'll all be saying, you know, is he going to be involved on Monday or not? But I don't know, it feels a bit like the Auras. He could be involved on Monday, and I don't really feel that arsed I don't know about anybody else, but
it's
interesting you mentioned a couple of those Chelsea players. I mean, he doesn't have to look too far for a player who probably wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Ancelotti in Alan in midfield, and none of us really look at him and expect this enormous performance or personality drop off, because you just get the feeling that that's not him, and maybe it is more James Rodriguez. And I know we speak on this podcast like we know the footballers integrally, but it is just a question of, as Matt said, just summing up that level of professionalism to, and as you said, Rob, get this job done. I mean, we speak about Benitez and James being at relatively similar points of their career. James Rodriguez has got an enormous peak to aim for, which is that World Cup coming up, which someone like Benitez probably doesn't have in his career. So that is, and that's where the weird dynamic comes in for what can James do for Everton, and what can playing regularly for Everton in the Premier League do for James Rodriguez. I think the awkward thing for Rodriguez now, which I'm sure, as Matt said, he probably knows from Madrid, is that stylistically, he is probably not someone who slots very easily into a Rafael Benitez football team anywhere. Never mind an Everton side where I think there's an accepted drop in quality in certain areas of the field, and someone like James is probably seen upon as a luxury by Benitez. And I think the fact that we're now coming into this game against Burnley as champions of August means that Benitez probably does look at this side and thinks, well, he's probably not a natural fit into this starting lineup. And realistically, we probably only see James Rodriguez going forward if what we've started to build in the very early stages of this season suddenly stops working. And there's an argument to say that if what Benitez is trying to do at Everton in terms of being a little bit more solid and potentially a little bit more conservative, but I think overall he's going to expect that work rate to be right up there. And he's not necessarily someone who you would picture in that mould. If Everton do consistently improve and kind of want to make this more structured approach to how they go about games, Rob, is James just one of those players who comes in when it's going tits up and we need something magical?
Yeah, well, I mean, you can't make the argument that you're pragmatic and then ignore a very useful, if limited, but still useful tool at your disposal, right? Yeah. I think that's the key. And you know, again, for those who haven't listened to the weekly, go listen to the weekly. You should always listen to the weekly. But this was discussed. Burnley, I think, is a great example. We had plenty of these games this past season. Not that James necessarily made a difference in every single one of them, but hey, let's be honest about our situation right now. You know, we've had a nice start so far. We've had a somewhat accommodating schedule, and those things are great. But I also think that stylistically, we matched up well in terms of what we wanted to do. There are going to, frankly, be teams like Burnley who are going to probably come and put 10 guys behind the ball, and you've got to find a way through. To me, you can still have all your principles. Patty and Greg wrote a really nice article in The Athletic today about the first couple of months of Benitez at Everton and about the emphasis on things like work rate and fitness and the collective mindset versus the individual mindset. And I fully understand that James Rodriguez does not fit nice and neatly into any of those sort of narratives or dynamics, what have you. But let's also acknowledge the reality that if you don't utilize James Rodriguez, where is the creativity from the midfield coming in this squad when you need it in those games where suddenly you're just basically dared to find a way through a giant wall of players? I think that we need to acknowledge the fact that we just don't have more of those types. And you can tell me all you want about system or whatever, but a smart manager can't bang his head against the wall with rigidity, you know, at all times. There's got to be, you know, those times when you find the right button to push and you But in order to have that button to push, you have to be able to push buttons. And he is, you know, James Rodriguez is a player that can do that on occasion. Again, it's not about whether or not the club wants rid of his salary. It's not about whether or not he is a long-term fit here. He's clearly not. We know he will not be here either in January or by the summer. Those things are fine. But the reality is today, this is the squad. You know, it's not, you know, you can't win games based on ideals. You have to win games with the players you have at your disposal. And so I think that Benitez will ultimately find some sort of role that enables him to get some playing time without the club and without the squad being overly reliant upon him, as it felt at times like we were all kind of waiting for him to come back from fitness so that we could be decent again. I would still remind people that, you know, we played with a flat back four and no James Rodriguez for almost all of December of last season and parts of November, I think, too. And we acquitted ourselves very well. Those things are possible. But as we saw the huge dip in form come at home against teams that we should have absolutely been beaten, it was I don't think people fully appreciate what a crime it was where we finished last season, given the schedule we had in front of us, given the opportunity we had, and especially given the home form. It really was. So I don't want a repeat of that. So I'm willing to swallow any issues I may have with James Rodriguez so that he can be a useful contributor during his, you know, limited time here at Everton.
I think just a couple more things I just want to sort of say on this is that I was critical at the end of last season for just sort of jetting out and not being at that Wolves game. You know, I don't think either he didn't handle it well or the club didn't handle it very well. I don't think it was handled well. But I think when Ancelotti left, everyone was sort of saying, "Well, we're never going to see him in Everton gear again. He's never going to come back." But since then, and obviously we're not privy to everything that goes on behind the scenes, but it seems like he's been professional in every sense of the word. You know, he was very much at the forefront of the pre-season in Colombia, against the Colombian side out there. You know, the club put him up for loads of media stuff. He seemed to, you know, be fully invested in training. He's come back. He's, you know, again, I think a lot of people this week, when they saw him out on that boat vaping with his mates, a lot of people thought, well, you know, I admit to myself.
I immediately respected him more after that, by the way.
at times, you look at it and you think, well, is he going to be back and training on time? You know, he's not got his move. You know, is this where, you know, maybe see him throw his toys at the pram a little bit? But he's back. He's been working hard based on the videos. He's fully invested in all this. And yeah, he said the odd stupid thing on Twitch while he's been speaking to supporters and stuff like that. But the actual stuff that matters in regards to being a trainer, investing in the football club, looking like he's arsed. You know, it seems like he's done all of those things. You know, Harry Kane literally cried off this summer earlier in the window because he didn't get the move he wanted.
Yeah,
and you know, there's not really been any of that from Rodriguez. You know, he's not threw his toys out the pram in that sense, but he's made himself so desperate to leave, and maybe that's because he's on 200 grand a week. You know, that might be something to do with it. And he lives in a lovely place called Formby up on the coast here in Liverpool as well. But you know, he's not gone to those lengths. He's not been unprofessional in that sense. Mm. And it seems like, you know, one of those Twitch streams where people have asked him about it, he said, "I want to play. I still want to play football." So it's not been like a full. He's got on strike. His agent's been mouthing off every week. He's been in the press saying about, you know, slagging the manager off and all, or his teammates off and that kind of thing. Even when those cop outs accosted him on the beach and they were asking about Jordan Pickford, he was like, "No, Jordan Pickford's great. You know, he's a really good keeper. You know, and those situations, a player who maybe wants to get off." They could have easily just said something a bit stupid to try and make the club force the hand, or, you know, accept something that they may not want to accept for him, or whatever else. But he's still here, and money might have a lot to do with that. And I think the other thing is that I'd say is that in football, things can change so quickly. If Everton are desperate on 60 minutes and they're 1-0 down on Saturday and Benitez throws him on, that lad can score a goal and set a goal up, and all of a sudden he's in the team. 100%. He's in the team for Villa then. And he, you know, because he is capable of doing things on a football pitch that mean that whatever manager we've got and whatever way we're playing, if he comes on for half an hour against Burnley, changes the game, he's got to be in the team at Villa. That's just how football goes, and he could end up having a good season here. And he might think, you know, the World Cup's only 6 months away. I want to stay where I am and keep playing where I am. This is for a player of his talent. That is is absolutely possible because he is good enough and he can change games quickly in an instant enough to force himself into the plans of any manager. And I think Benitez is obviously very stubborn and he'll have to do some pretty remarkable things, but he is capable of doing that. But Benitez, as we've all said, I've been saying on our shows all week, he is pragmatic as well. And if a lad comes on and changes a game for the better, which he's very much capable of doing, then I'm sure he'll be happy to use him going forward as well.
Well, and the last thing I'll say on James too is the club, from a big picture standpoint, have to be kind of careful here too, because to Matt's point, you know, James is not some poisonous personality in the dressing room. I mean, he is someone who is still, by all, you know, visual indicators, someone who appears to still be very popular with his teammates, but he is also regardless of how you feel about him or about it, about the fitness or where you feel like he has shortcomings or has let us down, he is still a superstar in this sport. Yeah. And for all the work that Everton have, you know, remember the day that James Rodriguez came, it wasn't just a happenstance or coincidence that suddenly we had an official Spanish account and that we were doing all of these marketing efforts in Latin America and specifically in Florida and in Colombia. These are things that are about laying a foundation for a future to be able to effectively recruit these types of profile players in the future for when we are at a place where we're actually competing for things. Mm. And so the club can't look like, you know, even if they sell James Rodriguez, which they will inevitably, or move him along or whatever you want to call it, they've got to find a way to do so in a way that does not detract and make Everton look like a club who was, you know, in any way lacking in professionalism or didn't treat him well, because that will have repercussions. And you can sit here, you can listen to me saying this and say, well, Rob, what do you care? You're always, you know, going on about Latin American players and all this other stuff. Well, that stuff matters because that's where a lot of the talent is. That's where also a lot of the future audience and frankly, new audience and new supporters for Everton are coming from. That stuff has tangible benefits and certainly has consequences to the fortune of the club. So it's not something that is just an easy decision to say, well, he should or shouldn't play or, you know, whatever, we can just write him off. I mean, I think Everton have to play this well, and I fully expect them to. I fully expect Benitez to find, even if it's in a limited way, some kind of somewhat meaningful role for James Rodriguez moving forward, not only for practical purposes that are about the short-term fortunes of the squad, but also about the long-term big picture for Everton. I think that they've got to find a way to handle this right, and mm-hmm. I am cautiously optimistic that they will.
And just one other small thing to sort of emphasize how quickly things can change. About a manager that's been in the news again for all the wrong reasons, a former manager of ours recently, Umar Nias was bullied by Ronald Koeman and didn't have a locker. And that lad ended up getting in the team and saving his skin at times in that season. You know, that is how quickly things can change in football. And if Umar Nias, who was bullied by the manager, forced to train with the under-23s, play with the under-23s, didn't have a locker, if that lad can force his way into the team and become a regular for large parts of that season, then someone like James Rodriguez, who is nowhere near as much out of favour and is much more talented, absolutely can.
I was going to say, Umar Nias did that, but he was absolutely bin juice at footy. So if he can do it, anyone can.
Legend. Absolute legend.
For North Liverpool listeners, if anyone does want to join Matt's Beach Blue Alliance that helps protect Richarlison and James Rodriguez on dog walks on Formby Beach, applications are definitely open. But lads, just to finish up, one more person going into Monday that I wanted to talk about, who up until today, probably, we didn't think it was going to be involved, but now, reassuringly, we're told by Rafa Benitez that Seamus Coleman will be back from this injury scare that we've seen over the international break. We all knew that we were going to have this conversation. The fact that we are having it a matter of days after the closing of the transfer window is just pure Everton poetry, but we knew that we were leaving ourselves short. Everton moved to, I'm going to say replace, but just instill some form of cover in the fullback areas and primarily at right back. And they moved at a glacial pace to do so and ended up missing out on Maitland-Niles, obviously, who, as rumours are to be believed, will be back in for in January. My question to you, Matt, at this stage is, are Everton in a situation to be able to turn down a move for Serge Aurier?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, he's shite and he'd be on loads of money. Like, I'd honestly rather see John Joe Kenny play at this point.
Wow.
Like, it
must be awful then.
he is one of those players you sort of watch and you just go, oh, he's just horrendous. Now, he's good going forward. I think he's put a good delivery in. But I don't think signing someone who's going to eat up more of our already overinflated wage bill on what will potentially be a two-year deal. Because if he's on a free transfer, he's going to be on massive wages. We'll have to pay him a big signing on fee. I just don't think he's of the right profile. I just don't think because we messed up in terms of not getting a right back in this summer means you just rush for the next one that's available. I think I'd rather see us muddle through to January or until the end of the season with a combination of Coleman, Holgate, Kenny, Godfrey, and just sort of get by. Because if we were in a position this season, I think where if we were all saying we've got a real chance of finishing top four, or we've got a real chance of getting in the top six, or we've got a real chance of winning one of the cup competitions, I'd probably be more open to just saying get someone in there who's a bit more experienced, who can offer something in the short term. But this season feels like it's one where we're ultimately going to have to take our medicine and just be an existing team in this league. And I think when you're in that kind of season, I want to be rushing out to try and get a short-term option who's going to eat up more money, who's not even that good anyway. So,
Rob, tell us why you disagree.
I don't fundamentally disagree, team. I mean,
you've got to disagree, Rob. Come on. People love confrontation.
No, well,
you've never seen TalkSport.
We already threw punches over your silly English blackout rules, so I feel like that was enough. But no, look, I feel very much like I think Patty sort of said it best that I'm just so tired of talking about it, and the fact that we're still talking about it is completely Everton's fault, and I do think, as you know, Alan isn't like, is he Irish and Portuguese? I can't remember. Alan Feely. Is he from, where's he from?
What do you mean?
I thought you meant Alan, the midfielder then. I was like, I don't think he's Irish.
No, Alan Feely, who's on the Blue Room.
Yeah,
remind me where he's from.
Can he play Cork, yeah.
Yeah, he's from, okay. I mean, he's in the bag for Seamus Coleman, which is fine because he's Irish and that's cool or whatever. I don't really feel the need to talk about my opinion of Seamus Coleman anymore. I think that it's not about him anymore. And I do think Seamus Coleman has been put in a very unfair position to become the brunt of a lot of criticism. I mean, he should face criticism because he's a bottom half right back in this league at this stage of his career. But it's not his fault that the club have not put him in a position to be the best version of himself or acknowledge the fact that he's getting older or continue to give him money and not spend money on any sort of, you know, reasonable replacement. I think the only question that mattered to me as we started to see the Dumfries options and the whatever options were there kind of fall by the wayside, the only question that really mattered to me at that stage was, can we find someone who is better than John Joe Kenny? Because frankly, the media, the club, the fan base essentially act as if John Joe Kenny doesn't exist as a right back option anyway. So that tells you everything you need to know about how, you know, we feel and really frankly how the club feels. And there's no getting around that in terms of the fact that John Joe Kenny does not appear to be a Premier League player. So it just mystified me that, to compound the issue, they let Niels Nkunku, for whatever good developmental reasons they may have had, go out on loan. And now you have no fullback coverage at all, other than John Joe Kenny, who you don't acknowledge to be even a Premier League player or a viable option. So I'm glad that Coleman can play. Look, absolutely, I'm rooting for Coleman to find a way to stay fit for every single game until January, or more likely until the summer, or even more likely actually till the summer of 2025 when we actually buy a new right back. I don't know. Whenever that time comes, you know, what have you. Maybe we'll have decided as a club that right back is a position that is antiquated and no longer matters in football, and we'll just play four center halves all the time. I don't really know what Everton's idea is here. But I don't care about the Serge Aurier question. I'll take your word on it that he's a bad egg. He's shite, whatever. You know, I've heard everything. He would cost too much money. Fine. It just seems to me that it seems odd to me that, you know, we had some money clearly in whatever weird math and accounting exercise we were going to do to be able to bid on Luis Diaz, to be able to bid on the Patterson kid from Rangers, to be able to, you know, even make a loan bid with an option to sign Maitland-Niles. So we had some money there. And the fact that we came away with nothing, not even a guy that is marginally better on a one-year deal, like the way we covered Calvert-Lewin at the end of last season, like the fact that we couldn't even get that guy on a short-term deal just for, you know, in the break glass in case of emergency sort of scenario, it's just pure mismanagement. And I don't know how many more times I need to say it. It's unacceptable. And anyone who, what happened when Coleman got injured on duty with Ireland, I laughed my ass off because it is absolutely what Everton deserve. And frankly, the fact that, you know, Coleman has found a way, is apparently going to find a way to be fit for Burnley.
Yeah.
Good on him. We need him. I need Coleman because he's the only right back at the club. So we need him to find a way to be fit. But Everton deserve whatever consequences of their actions they get out of this, because to come away with nothing at the end of, you know, and to say, well, you know, it's tough on deadline day. They had the whole fucking summer. So there's got to be some basic accountability, which will never get, because, you know, the people who actually make the decisions literally never have to get up in front of an audience of journalists and actually answer basic questions about, well, what was your thinking in terms of allowing Niels Nkunku out on loan while not, you know, bringing in a right back? Like, we are left to speculate and, you know, fill all of this narrative with all of our conjecture, because we have accepted, and maybe this is sort of like the blackout thing over there, we've accepted that the decision makers never have to answer questions about any of these things. Instead, we're going to get the three, you know, people who have been blessed or whatever to have some sort of media access to Everton in the form of like a Paul Joyce or, you know, a Dominic King or whatever, to maybe hopefully write a snippet in an article that if we have a subscription, one, you know, we can see, or one of our friends will cut and paste into a WhatsApp article about how Brands actually feels about one of these players, or about why Everton decided not to get this, you know, to do this things. The lack of transparency and accountability is a fucking joke. And I'm tired of it. But at the same time, there's far too many people who sort of accept that this is just how it is. Having said all of that, I heard, you know, I get it. If the idea is, well, just get through this season, and if you have to use, you know, you have to use a midfielder out of position, or use the Les Roberts idea of putting Tom Davis right back, or you got to, you know, find a way to just get weird with it and just play a flat back four.
I'm all in on that.
Fine. If that's what it takes for us to get our financial footing back so we can buy right back, then fuck it.
Left back.
If someone mentions Fabian Delph, I'm just going to end this recording.
It's going to be Delph, and you know it. It's going to be Delph, or we're just not going to play fullbacks. And Ben Godfrey can't cover three positions, which is essentially now what we're putting him forward to do. And by the way, what is the idea that, like, Michael Keane hasn't exactly inspired much confidence in me. I love Yerry Mina, but he's got to stay fit. He's like, it's all of these variables that we're just sort of hoping that if the wind is blowing the right day, and if I'm bouncing myself on that rope right, and if the net is not loose at the bottom, that I'm going to find a way to get across this canyon. And the fact that Everton tries to find ways to move forward with hands tied behind their back is completely a mess of their own making. But you'll never convince me, regardless of the FFP rules that no one really fully understands, that we couldn't have gotten a short-term option been better than John Joe Kenny in here for one season. I'm sorry, you'll never convince me of it. And if that's your assertion, then fine, but I'll never ever believe it.
Just imagine Andros Townsend bombing around the outside of Damari Gray and dropping those unbelievable crosses on Salomon Rondon. Perfect. That's going to be the new Rodriguez to Dinia to Calvert-Lewin combination. Gray to Townsend to Rondon.
I can see him.
Going to be our route to goal all season.
I can see him really chasing Adama Traore back towards towards our own penalty boxes.
Hey, Ralph. And for anyone who thinks we're only negative, by the way, how great have Damari Gray and Andros Townsend been for the prices we paid for them? I mean, they've been fantastic.
And just one thing I did want to say before we finish, just to wrap up, I do want to just say I think Coleman has been really good when he's played for a while now. Probably going back towards the end of last season when he was in the team and he was brought in for various games and brought in off the bench. I think he's played dead well for a lot of games. He had two really good games during the international break as well. And I think he's showing signs, I think, for probably the first time of being able to adapt his game and pick his moments on when to go forward. I think defensively he looks a lot more switched on. And I think while he's not going forward as much, when he does get forward now, he tends to be a bit more purposeful with it and picks his options a lot better. And you know, winning that penalty at Brighton was a really canny bit of play.
Yeah,
you know, that was just a really experienced fullback, knowing exactly what he's doing, putting his body in the right place and getting a penalty for his team. So I think I probably won't play him on Monday if there's any doubt whatsoever about his fitness, because you've got to look after him over the course of the campaign. But if he's 100% fit, obviously, you know, be willing to give him a go. But I think whenever he's played, you know, albeit there's been little spells we've been out injured, but probably since that mad Spurs game, the 5-4, when he came off the bench that night and played really well. I think probably since then, whenever he's been given an opportunity, he's been playing really well. And I've not always been his biggest fan. I've been critical of him a lot in the past, but pretty much throughout this entire year, whenever he's been on the pitch for Everton, he's done a pretty good job, despite the fact we've had to run him into the ground at times.
I think Coleman, by the way, I think Coleman's been fine, and I'm not, you know, my critiques of Coleman are mostly to do with just the fact that I feel like we could and should be doing, you know, better in that position. If we're signing Luka Dean on the left side, I don't understand why there has not been more of a push to sign someone on the right side. And you can tell me all you want.
Just on that, right, Robbie?
I just don't believe that.
I think he's been playing better than Luka Dean for a while now.
I don't know that I'd go that far, but I do think that Luka Dean probably needs to show a little more. That's fine. But having said all of that, Coleman could be playing out of his mind. He is still of a certain age with his injury record, and you are just asking for trouble. And it's not about Coleman. And Everton would prefer for us, for the fans to squabble about, you know, this being a debate over Coleman. It's not a debate about Coleman. It's a debate about Everton and Everton's inability to address basic needs. It is not about lacking ambition. It's not about, well, they didn't go out and sign a 50 million pound right back. It is about just addressing the basic squad depth that every side needs. Every other side in this league, I think right now, and correct me if I'm wrong, has a backup right back. Are we the only ones who don't have a backup right back? Oh, I'm sorry. John Joe Kenny is our backup right back. I keep forgetting. See, and that's the thing, is that the fact that I even, you know, go into that place just tells you where we're at. But we don't have a backup for Luka Dean to match.
Liverpool have one?
And Luka, do they use Milner? Well, no, does Milner back up at left or right? I always forget.
Every midfielder at Liverpool can play across the back four now.
Yeah, probably. Pretty
much they just play 8-2.
Hey, Matt, to your point about Luka Dean, and I'll even agree with you that Luka Dean could be playing better. He's got no one pushing him back there. No one. And that's not even in Nkunku. I mean, not even a kid. He's got no one pushing him back there. It's just not a way to run a club. And it's just, you can say it's the chickens coming home to roost or whatever, but I don't understand how they have not found a way to address things that every other club seems to address, at least on a marginal level. And it's a low bar. It really is.
I agree. Welcome, Serge. Rob, I don't know what I would prefer more to send me to sleep at night, if it's you saying shite or I need Colton.
Shite.
If you could just put those two things together for
what was the second one? What was the second one?
I need Coleman.
I need
to hear you say that you need Seamus Coleman in conversation before.
Well, yeah. If you edit out the end of my sentence, I need Coleman to fuck off. I need Coleman to never come back. I'm just kidding. We as fans. Because we want good things for Everton, need Coleman to stay fit beyond all logic, apparently, but we need him to stay fit. So I only say shite because for some reason saying shit with you guys feels sometimes off-putting. But I don't know. I hope he stays healthy forever. And I hope he's leading us into Bramley Moore at age 48 or whatever. And it'll be awesome. And our friend Laura will be so happy to see Seamus Coleman on his walker out there, waddling his way out to right back as we line up in the 2026-27
season. He'll be manager by then.
Oh God, he probably will be manager by then. Oh my God, because Leighton Baines doesn't have any he's coaching, but I don't think Leighton Baines wants to be a manager. I'm surprised Leighton Baines even took a job at the club. I thought he just wanted to go play. I think that if there was no COVID, the Leighton Baines would have just been going to music festivals and never coming back. Oh. But I guess he's a dad too, right? He's got kids, so maybe.
Well, hopefully Seamus Coleman can drag himself out on Monday night, because I think we've all highlighted how incredibly desperate the nature of this squad is. So,
you guys think Godfrey plays right back?
Do you know what he
plays? Or left back, or I'm sorry. God, does he play at all on Monday? I don't even know. I assume he does.
Yeah, I mean, if it's to be believed, I think he and Yerry Mina are very much in contention. Seamus Coleman as well, so... It's probably going to look strong, but the nature of having a relatively streamlined squad is that early in the season, it is going to look strong, but that's exactly the time where you need to put points on the board, because if that weekend of international football has kind of warned us to teach us anything, it's that you are going to lose people. So in our eternal desire to break down the season into a million mini-seasons, we now play Burnley, Aston Villa and Norwich, with obviously that QPR League Cup game in the middle. So there's plenty of opportunity for Everton to put some early points on the board and to build on what's been a really promising start. But yeah, that's been us from another week of the Kickabout. Matt, thanks very much for joining us. I know we obviously referenced that weekly show, which is out already. Matt, you did the preview with Natalie Bromley from Burnley as well. What minute of the game did she predict that Dwight McNeil obviously scores against us?
Oh, yeah.
Natalie's boss, to be fair. She's one of her favourite people to speak to on the preview. She's always got great in. I think we all sort of look at Burnley and go, slack them off a little bit. Yeah, but, it's obviously a lot more nuanced than that, but yeah, it's well worth a listen. Got time.
Well, no, that'll be slagging them off on Monday, but hopefully it's on the back of another league win. So yeah, thanks very much for joining us. From Matt, myself and Rob, that's been your Kickabout.
Únese al equipo de BD en Columbus, Nebraska. Estamos contratando para múltiples posiciones con elegibilidad de bonos de inicio de trabajo. Nuestro plan de beneficios integral comienza para todos sus empleados en su primer día, incluyendo los planes de seguro de bajo o ningún costo para algunas posiciones, las oportunidades de crecimiento de la carrera y más. BD está hecho para lo que viene en la salud y su carrera. Solicite hoy en jobs.bd.com. Jobs.bd.com.
Sports Social Podcast Network.